From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
I'm Elvis Mitchell. Welcome to a special edition of The Treatment, recorded before a live audience. I interviewed Dan Harmon, creator of Community and executive producer of That Show and Rick and Morty, a few weeks ago at a private home in Pasadena. Here's the conversation.
Thank you for having me. They've vested me with some tasks back there. You guys have to know that we're recording, and you have to turn off your cell phones. And there's 70 silver Priuses with their lights on out front. That last one was just a little public radio joke.
It would only play in this room. A block away from here, they wouldn't even laugh at that.
I wrote it over by the canapes. Which I just found out were not pronounced canapes.
So it's not crudites either then,
nope,
right?
Nope, not crudites.
Another public radio joke. It's already gotten too esoteric in here.
Did you know that the crudites actually defeated the...
the Hittites?
The Cenobites outside the Hellraiser?
That's in the next sequel. I have to say, one of the things I love so much about your work is even... Just thinking about, you know, Rick and Morty, first of all, a TV show where the kid has the name of an old Jewish comedian, and the grandpa is named Rick.
His name is Rick Sanchez. His last name is Sanchez for some reason.
Yeah. I don't know if anybody knows this show on Adult Swim, but it's a really terrific show. And one of the greatest things I think I've ever seen was the Lawnmower Dog episode, which is, you have to describe a little bit for the audience.
It's a traditional A-B story setup. The A story is that the patriarch of the family, who's this sort of Charlie Brown figure, is voiced by Chris Parnell from SNL, who does this great job as a sort of modern dad who married out of his league and is sort of just trying to keep his family together. He requests that his father-in-law, the titular Rick, use his super science powers to make their family dog smarter because it keeps peeing in the house. So the Rick warns him of pulling at that thread before making a cognition amplifier for the dog. The dog becomes sentient, goes through all the things you would expect a dog to do if it gained sort of self-awareness. It's watching the Discovery Channel and realizes it's the result of selective breeding and becomes incredibly offended by that. It's descended from wolves, and yet now it's like it's been physically like bred to be adorable, and it ends up not only modifying its own cognition amplifier, but then modifying a kind of body armor suit that it can use to actually get some work done, and recruits the dogs around the neighborhood, and pretty soon the dogs are taking over the world. And then the B story, it's an Inception parody,
which I mean. That show has one of my favorite lines that I think I've ever heard in anything. What happened to my testicles?
Yeah, we gave the dog wants to be able to speak, so yeah, we spent a long time creating this synthesized voice that the dog would have for itself, and it's just this actor kind of, it's just this little white kind of shih tzu staring at you, sitting in this giant suit of body armor, looking at the daughter as the rain pounds on the window and the thunder rolls overhead, saying, "Where are my testicles? Where are my testicles, Summer?"
Except much mellower than that. It's very much like it's almost like hearing the computer from 2001, the voice that the dog gives itself.
Well, I love that. I mean, that's one of my favorite characters in cinematic history is Hal. It's just such an amazing, like the smartest guy in the room who self-destructs, you know. And
you want to talk about that?
I've always aspired to be Hal. Also just the idea of watching a character die like that. That riveting thing where you the idea that you can create a character that doesn't have arms, legs, a mouth, eyes, anything, and you can still feel pain as you listen to this thing lose its consciousness while this scientist floats around in zero G pulling out different parts of its brain and it's trying to sing some childhood song. It's amazing.
Well, as you bring this up, the things that come to mind, first of all, that so many of these things you've done have been about characters trying to maintain some pose of dignity long after it's like threadbare and useless. And that's kind of the center of everything you do. And it's, you think about the end of 2001, where Hal is doing that, trying to maintain, even as he's dying, trying to maintain his dignity.
Yeah.
And that's a big thing for you, isn't it?
For me, the big thing is humanity versus systems. You know, my dad was literally a redheaded stepchild that grew up in a trailer park. His mom, you know, went from dad to dad. Our family assembled itself without pedigree, out of dirt, without permission. And he...
You just described community, by the way.
he didn't give me a trust fund. He taught me not to kiss any ass, and he taught me that people would expect me to. And I observed what self-reliance was from watching him. And I guess I have a huge chip on my shoulder about class and about systems. I resent rich people so much. I can't wait to be one of them. so I can really start making some changes to the way they do things.
Have you noticed where we are, by the way?
Yeah, my Prius is number 71 out there with the lights on. But more than about class system, it's really about that larger class system, which is about systems. Like, I don't believe in conspiracies. I don't think that there's actually fat old white men chomping cigars and making decisions about secrets. You know, well, okay, I do believe that, but
sound too worked out for you not to believe some part of it.
I also think that we all do that. We all have conversations. We all conspire against each other, but. The idea of a system, the idea that we have these things that aren't human, that actually, for all intents and purposes, are alive, that have hearts that beat, that want to preserve themselves. You know, they're very dangerous to the individuals that create them because they stop caring about the individuals that create them. I'm obsessed with that in particular. And I feel like television is huge, you know, there's a huge guilt that you take on if you're a successful TV writer. You know that you're shoving a pacifier into the mouth of people that you supposedly care about, and you can only make them laugh if you care about them.
Isn't that how Channel 101 started? Is basically a slap in the face of that?
Yeah,
that
kind of going, screw you, like TV. They're trying to take the art out of TV. What has TV really created that is beneficial? My answer to that would be, well, it's about the populism. It's about the fact that if you're writing TV, unlike if you're writing cinema, you have no choice as a TV writer, TV producer, TV director, TV actor, to wake up every morning and realize that your job is to make people happy, that the customer is always right. You can go to a film festival and make people watch 45 minutes of a tea kettle whistling in black and white, and you can hear nothing from the audience, and you can still walk out with your beret on feeling like maybe you nailed it. You're allowed to lie to yourself. You can say, well, they didn't get it.
No, you can't. No, you can't. No, I've seen that film. Well, you can't
you'll
get
walk
away
out
with
of it.
That.
Yeah, I know. And then you'll be like, oh, this tea kettle shouldn't have worn its glasses. And they're like, oh, that was an early script. Okay. All right. But in TV, if people aren't laughing and they're not crying and they're not responding, and if you're not hitting your story points in a timely fashion, it's just customer satisfaction. You're held accountable by the people that supposedly we're all trying to connect with. That's what Channel 101 was really about.
It was also sort of making fun of the idea that these things, these responses are quantifiable. That if you do this and this and this, you'll get this response. Almost every piece there at some point asks you a question about you almost Pavlovian responses to those things.
Yeah, and you would be amazed if you've got 325-year-old kids in a theater downtown and there's absolutely no S&P, there's no FCC, there's no cap on the content, and yet it levels out around a rated R plus a couple of bumps, because people find out if I try to get a laugh with the C word or the N word or this genital mutilation or whatever, you know,
I'm laughing already.
They experiment. They're free to experiment, and they're free to find out what actually naturally makes people happy and what turns them off and stuff, without having this suit tell you, oh, we know that you need a dog in this because people love a dog. They come around to finding out that they put a dog in it and it's kind of dynamite, and it helps them subvert, you know, a lot of tropes and stuff. It's pretty cool to watch, you know, punk rock television.
But that's what it is. And that sort of simultaneous sort of questioning, but at the same time wanting to try to figure out what the parameters of entertainment can be outside of those kind of norms that TV dictates is a big part of what you do too.
Yeah. I mean, it couldn't be a more insane irony, the fact that if you're allowed to be heard by people, if I can talk and 100 people hear me, I have no higher chance of subversion. You know, I can actually, now I have 100 times the power that I had in my bathroom mirror, and yet I also have 100 times the political pressure. I now am, if I have 100 times supposedly less freedom to say what I want and stuff. I'm fascinated with that stuff.
But I was just thinking to when I was saying about dignity before, you just thinking about Jack and Heat Vision and Jack, or even Pierce on Community and Chris's character on Rick and Morty. These are guys who want to be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And that idea of somebody who shouldn't be taken seriously, who desperately needs that kind of, who's so insecure, the white man who feels like he's somehow missing out on something, right, is a big part of what you do too.
Yeah, I like the idea that there's no such thing as villains too. Like Archie Bunker was a big hit when I was a kid, and I had a grandpa who literally bayoneted the enemy at Guadalcanal and had every reason to be what Archie Bunker was and believe and feel how he felt. You know, what are these goddamn Japanese cars all of a sudden? I thought they were the enemy. You know, he was Archie Bunker. He had old world values, and he would watch that show and laugh at it just as much as his hippie son, my uncle, who spray painted a peace sign in the basement and got yelled at for it. And like, they both sat there and watched Archie Bunker say what he said to Meathead and Meathead respond, and both of them sat there and laughed. And I remember that. That's just not from some essay that I read about how TV works. Like, that was a real thing happening in a house in Milwaukee on a snowy street. That was really what was happening, because humans are good the way they are. Some of them are racist. Some of them are tall. Some of them are short. Those are the only three things you can be as a human. It's either that or you're a giraffe. Some of them are deeply, deeply flawed, but every single one of them is better than a dead person. Every single one of them is better than a rock. And with, at the risk of offending PETA, they're all more important to us than giraffes.
I mean, this is public radio too, right? I just want to explain where you are.
I know. And I applaud people who have different convictions about that. They go like, no, let's start with giraffes and let's work our way around to these weird apes that are threatening their lives. But I think that you start like, what did I say about the cell phone?
I don't know. What did you say about the cell phone?
I said, turn them off.
Thank you.
You rich weirdos. So just your nannies are texting you to tell you that your children still kind of remember that you're their parents.
I didn't know it was going to get sentimental this fast. This gotten so warm all of a sudden. I love this in front of a fireplace.
You just missed Tommy's first laugh. That's the text you just got.
Oh, the sound of therapy everywhere in the neighborhood. But that thing you're talking about, that anger is in this thing you're doing.
The thing I was talking about, yeah.
And the thing, which is the thing you're displaying, which is the fuel that drives all these things you've done. It's some weird, or for these characters, justifiable streak of anger.
Yeah, I'm mad. I am.
Yes, you are. Yeah. Yes, you are.
Yeah, I have a weird streak of rage. Like, it's not cool, and it's not something that I enjoy, and I don't think it's something that, if I weren't 41, if I was 28, I would pretend that it had something to do with my work being good so that I could justify it. But I'm 41 and I want to have kids and I want to settle down. And I don't think you have to be angry or go dark in order to be meaningful. I think that, in fact, I'm at a threshold in my career where I have to face the fact that, okay, you've got permission to not clean your room. What are you going to do instead? You know, it's that anger comes from some infantile defense. Like, no one tell me what to do. Everyone give me space. Everyone back up. Everyone stop telling me what to do. People have been telling me what to do forever. Oh, if only they knew what I would do if they stopped telling me what to do. Like, then you meet with that goddess, as Joseph Campbell would say, and the next step is you have to become something special. You got to earn that space.
You've been listening to a special live edition of The Treatment recorded in Pasadena with Dan Harmon, creator of Community and Rick and Morty.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
Welcome to a special live edition of The Treatment recorded in Pasadena. I'm speaking to Dan Harmon, creator of Community and Rick and Morty.
But I've been to a couple of Harmontown things, and you like stoking that anger, though. I mean, once you get it going, once you lit the fuse, you just want to cut it and have it burn that much faster.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a kid sucking his thumb, you know? It's just like, it's an addiction. I sat with with Mitch Hurwitz, who's got a good 10 years on me, creator of Arrested Development, who I would like to call a friend really quickly without smothering him. But we sat and had a drink, which was a fantasy of mine for a long time, and we talked about the darkness, the anger, the rage. And he's a very affable guy. Like he gets accused of being duplicitous and passive aggressive by the suits because he has this big smile on his face. He's like a cherub, and then they find out that he didn't address any more notes than I do, and they accuse him of all this stuff. But we talked about it, and he was it was pretty profound conversation that I don't remember any of because I drank more than him. But I remember him talking about that anger, and we realized that it's doing an impression of your dad because it's the first guy you meet, and if you're lucky enough to have a dad, and you're lucky enough to have an effective dad, whether he's effective in a good way, a bad way, whatever modern fashion ends up characterizing his efficacy as, you know, that's not your inevitability, but it is the comfort zone. It is the thumb you're going to stick in your mouth when you're feeling jeopardized.
Like, but these ad hoc families that exist in your worlds, they seem kind of be dysfunctional until these characters have gone into the real world and see how much worse it is. I mean, that's a big part of the comedies that you do too.
Right. They always find out how much worse it would be if they didn't have permission to be the animals that they are. They always find out it would be worse than they think without each other. They experiment. The TV's story model is a bit of a sinister evolution because you have to reduce the overhead. You have to minimize the amount of sets. You can't hire different actors from episode to episode. So what that ends up with is instead of a movie where Neo from The Matrix makes you feel like you should go out and flip a cop car over, and the movie can make money that way, a TV show can't really blow up the Death Star at the end of every episode. So we've sort of settled into an unfortunate story model that actually teaches you about the futility of change. And that's a very dangerous thing.
But it's also antithetical with drama. Drama is conflict and change. TV is about stasis.
It's true, but overall, the doctor who's ripping things from the headlines and saving the kid that's abused because he noticed the cigarette burns on her arm in the emergency room, or the cop detective that helps him out, these hour-long drama characters.
I don't mean dramatic television. I mean drama on the stage. You know, if we're going to like the Aristotelian model of that, it would be that drama is about conflict and change. Mm-hmm. TV is about wanting to make us come back to see these people every week.
Right. TV is an appliance. And if you could talk to your refrigerator, it would suggest that milk stay cold. And if you could talk to your television, it would suggest that you stay in your living room. That's an important thing to realize, that it's only doing its job by telling you through every news anchor, every character, every story, what it's suggesting to you is that your neighbors are bad people, that fires await down the street and things. It's a very dangerous tool. It's a very dangerous mirror that we invented when you know these crazy people from whom we descended went so far west that they hit another ocean. You know, they stopped and created this crazy black mirror that you stare into and see nothing but fantasy. And that fantasy has become a dangerous opiate. Anyways, you can subvert that opiate by saying, okay, yes, the story model demands that people experiment with change, and it turns out to be futile. All you have to do, or all I do to cope with that guilt of being a purveyor of that opiate, is to say, okay, the change they're going to experiment with is the idea that we should be perfect people. And they'll find out the futility of that idea. They'll experiment with the idea of being autonomous as animals. They'll experiment with the idea of being less of the flawed people that they were. And they'll find out in the end, no, I was fine the way I was in the beginning. Actually, that's the more subversive and heroic, comforting thought.
But I was just thinking about that because I wondered, I mean, obviously when you did Heat Vision and Jackie, you were working with Ben Stiller, who brought you in to basically do something that was different from television. But when you go in to Sony and NBC and you tell them what you want Community to be, you can't really tell them what you want it to be because they wouldn't let you make it, right?
I mean, the truth is it's an organic process. I went into – when I heard NBC wanted to work with me, I thought this is my retirement plan. This is not my chance to do anything out of the ordinary. This is my chance to play ball.
You thought you could?
I thought I could, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I try every week. I swear to God, I do. I really do. I mean, it's 5 years later, but it really was my attempt at a mainstream bullseye. It really was. I know that's sad, but that I think you'll find that you talk to a lot of the people who are, you know, applauded for some kind of, you know, their fringe television shows that are too smart to get high ratings and stuff. They'll all tell you the same thing, I think. They'll all tell you that, oh no, I thought this would be a hit. I thought this was like chicken soup for the soul. I really did. And I don't think I could get out of bed if I didn't think that I had a shot at 20 million people suddenly waking up and realizing it was a great show. I accept that it's only 2 million people and a lot of cats. But I also have to believe, like, I'm a student of Zemeckis and Spielberg and Lucas. I'm not. I wasn't into French New Wave when I was growing up. I believed in this fantasy of, you know, you can make the popcorn and you can have a 100 IQ or a 200 IQ. You can be from any profession or background, and good is good and bad is bad.
But those guys you're talking about, even Kubrick, there was a kind of almost kinetic aspect to their excitement about making these things, and. I kind of feel that way, too. I mean, just seeing when in this new season of Community, after the repilot episode, where we see Jeff become a teacher and he can't do the things he did. And it's almost like you're using that, strictly speaking, as your metaphor for having gone through what you went through, about you can't be the bomb thrower anymore. You've got to be the person who tries to toe the line. But you really, how do you stop being yourself?
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're all like these action figures. We all have these weapons that the manufacturer put in our hands, or you swing around, and like sometimes I think you're hitting people that weren't attacking you, and you just have this kung fu grip that you kind of you come with. And it's like, I think it's a healthy thing. I think most authority are bad people. Otherwise, how did they end up in authority? Like it's better to hate them by default. I think you raise your batting average by doing that. I'm mixing a lot of metaphors tonight.
I got that, but I was gonna say, though, you were saying at the outset, and you said this before, that you don't really think there are villains, but clearly people who have been authority are villains, just based on this description.
I don't trust them, you know? If your job is to tell me what to do, I think that's weird. I think that
But you have a job where you tell people what to do.
I do, there couldn't be a bigger irony. The things that I admire in the younger writers coming up under me are not the things I would have practiced coming up, because they're staff writers for one thing, and I was never a staff writer. That's one of the issues. I never earned my. I didn't come up through the trenches. I just kept writing pilots until one of them stuck. And because I never believed in, I couldn't picture myself sitting around a table and pitching jokes and collaborating. It sounded like a profanity, like of something that should be sacred. But that was the 28-year-old me who was taking himself way too seriously.
But you were still this guy with the kung fu grip, and that your hand is on every episode of the show. I mean, each episode you've worked on, the fingerprints of Dan Harmon are all over it.
Yeah, if you want something done right. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, I need as much control as they'll give me. There's always a way to make a joke 5% funnier by trimming 8 frames off of the tail of the setup. You know, you got to spend 36 hours in the edit bay. You have to do a pass on every script. You have to. One of the cool things that I've discovered recently, because I had this great writing staff for season 5 and finally became comfortable enough to go through a script and actually, in advance of them, write out the rhythm of things that should be happening and put in placeholders, and actually accept the fact that as you get older, you're probably less funnier and less grammaticalized. less funny than the, you know, kid coming right off of The Onion and jumping onto your writing staff whose brain is on fire. You make room for that person, and I just kind of like my job becomes, okay, this is rhythm. This is I write these spit drafts where it says Jeff enters, and then his dialogue will say, I'm so narcissistic that blank, you know, it doesn't. It's just fake dialogue, and you kind of feed it to a room with, I put 3 question marks in the script.
You basically write that as if you're writing character motivation and when you're doing these placeholder things?
Yeah. So it's like I'm in charge of this. I execute the story, and also I dictate, like, okay, there needs to be three jokes on this page. I don't know what they are. That's your tough luck. You put three question marks so that they can search for them in a different room. So when community is operating at its peak efficiency, you've got that kind of furnace going where there's a room full of really gleeful, really happy joke writers that are going from question mark to question mark, calling out the craziest stuff they can think of. Then that gets fed back in, and I pick my favorite or maybe run it through my weird fingers again or something. But
there's got to be two things that really feel antithetical to you. One, you now have trust in people. And two, you're getting a group of writers who probably can work on this show because they fell in love with it. Right. Two things you probably 5 years ago could never have imagined.
Yeah, yeah. The big turning point for Community was in season two when the Chris McKenna coming on board, his name can't be mentioned enough. He's truly the reason why Community is a great show.
He left when you left, and he came back with you.
I'll cry if I start talking about his loyalty. The fact that in a city run on politics and an industry run on greed, that he was by far the only person that ever had a chance to run that show without me. And he was the only one loyal enough to turn that job down, in spite of having a kid on the way. And apparently it's the only thing I hold precious is loyalty. Like, I probably stepped over a homeless guy on the way here, but I start talking about Chris McKenna's loyalty to me, and I'll start crying because I'm that petty. But
what you're talking about here is the thing that really is at the heart of every episode of Community. There's an emotional issue. An often unsolved emotional issue, but you do that in every episode. And what you're talking about, as you talk about Chris, I can feel that you, despite these elbows you're throwing all the time, you are trying to communicate with people.
I love the audience. I swear, if I could just work for them, that would be great. It would not pay as well, but I trust their opinion, and I trust it in the form of laughs and most recently tweets. I think those are better. I trust less your 7-paragraph essay as an individual.
I can leave now then is what you're saying.
No, not yours. The royal you. Okay. Some other guy who's a terrible writer, Elvis. The individual, I think Tarantino said something that I would brutalize by paraphrasing, something about individuals being idiots and audiences being geniuses. I think what he meant is that, you know, emotional reactions to things, people saying, yay, I like Abed. That's actual sincerity. That's an actual thing you can and should take to the bank. A little less than that is somebody's grad school paper about, a study of Abed in spectrum characters throughout the history of blah, blah, blah.
And the thing that Abed's making fun of as a character.
Right. Sometimes, yeah, running up against academia. So if people aren't laughing, then I did my job wrong. I never, ever in my entire life have ever walked away from an unsatisfied audience blaming them, ever. I'll never do that. But I will sometimes, if someone's job is to stand between me and that audience and they aren't just saying, I got lost on page 8, or I didn't get this joke. Me, John Schmengenheimer from this studio or that studio, when they say, people don't like this, they're not going to like that, I don't think this is going to be funny, I distrust that by default, and I think it should be distrusted. But still, if I can play ball with those people, great. Like there's probably usually a way, there's a thought that they can have that can lead to something that improves the content.
I'm sure you've seen now the same thing you saw with the evolution of being on this show for 5 years. There are probably now executives who get the show just because it's proven itself.
Yeah, it's actually, it's a peaceful time right now. This season has been great. Yeah, I haven't had a single, I'm my own worst enemy. They figured out probably by accident, give me rope. Just give me all the rope. If the second half of season 5 of Community sucks, like I got nobody to blame but myself. I've the kids that are talking on the phone to us about the scripts and episodes that are coming in at the network and studio probably resent being called kids, but for me it's a term of endearment. They were there from the beginning at a lower rank, and they've now they're the ones that collaborating with, and it's very peaceful, very cool. They like the show, and we just work together to try to make it as good as we can.
But you've got to feel too, being back on the show with Chris now, it must feel like in some ways a dream come true. And now what do I do?
Yeah, no, it's a total nightmare. But you wouldn't have it any other way, though. I mean, that's like, I'm one of those weird personalities that that started doing stand up in Milwaukee. I mean, that's a weird choice you make, because you're gravitating towards this self-destruction. Like, you want abuse. You want to push things as far as you can, as fast as you can, and figure out if you're a good or a bad person.
I mean, it's so much of this. I mean, obviously, there's some part of you in all these characters and community, but so much of this is Jeff's sort of thing about pushing people away by virtue of being genetically like the best property around, but also having this complete fear of people getting to know him.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, he's an expert at keeping people at arm's length. And I've always said the irony with Jeff is that the reason he does that is because he knows more than anyone that he is the most sensitive. He will be the first person to get victimized in his eyes by a needy biomass around him. He won't be able to get anything that he's ever wanted if he even opens that door to asking what other people want. I based that on an experience I had going to a grocery store once, where I, you know, my neighbor was outside of it, and he was a World War II vet, and he was in this. He had left his crutches in the grocery store by the eggs, and I recognized him, and I bothered to say hi to him, even though he was always kind of cranky with me. And you think I'll just do that good deed, and that'll improve my day. It'll be like adding Splenda to my coffee. Like, we all win. But then, like, he's got dementia, so he doesn't know I'm helping him. He's yelling at me, and I gotta find his crutches by the eggs, and then I'm getting yelled at by the guy by the eggs because it looks like I'm stealing crutches from the egg section. And then I help him, and he doesn't know where he is, but he knows he needs he gets like a special veterans cab, and we figure out how to call it, and I'm putting him in. And then there's this other guy that, like, he got angry because we were blocking the doorway, and he started yelling at me. And then I said, "This guy's he's a disabled veteran. He's just trying to get into his cab." And then and then that guy started yelling at me because he was disabled too, and he started yelling at me like in this parking lot, and everyone's gathering around with this. And the guy was deaf, kind of, I guess. So he was yelling in a very distinct, sympathetic voice that was definitely made me the William Atherton in the situation. Like, I was definitely the villain. And I just kept thinking, like, I got to stop leaving my apartment. Because this is not a business that I'm ever supposed to be good at, like helping people. It's not what Dr. Seuss told you. It's not how it works. It doesn't. A little Visine drop doesn't clear the red, you know. It doesn't. It just complicates things. I think that's how Jeff Winger feels. He's nervous about helping people.
I gotta say, just hearing you, it's shocking to me how much sensitivity there is in that show, and even in Rick and Morty. I mean, there's this sort of core, these exposed nerve endings, and how people deal with them is where comedy comes from for you. Be it passive aggressive or angry, or attempts to be helpful. I mean, all these archetypes that are of community, that sensitivity is one of these things you're constantly addressing, isn't it?
I thank you for noticing. we're scared of dying, right? Like, we're naked, hairless apes that were cursed with consciousness, and we unlike giraffes, we have to walk around knowing that we're killing by living, and we're gonna die ourselves, and it's a real mind bender, and we distract ourselves and cope with it, and we come up with ways to convince ourselves that we can be the exception if we just behave this way or sell this person out. And like the fear and anxiety, like, it's not good for capitalism. It doesn't work. You know, Coke's slogan doesn't work if it incorporates the idea that we're all gonna die. It works better if it makes you feel like everything's running very smoothly. So we all walk around with this very potent underbelly to how we feel about the world. And that is where comedy comes from. If you go on a canoeing trip with your friends, you're going to remember it less unless the canoe capsizes. it's like a big, big fun memory. Everybody's clothes gets wet, and, you know, they don't design rides at Disneyland to keep you dry.
But I was just watching this, just get ready for this. So I was struck by the fact that I couldn't think of anybody who used, again, that exposed nerve quality as kind of if I can mix a metaphor here, as a foundation for work. I mean, it's really unique to you.
I hope that's true. You're making me feel so legit. I assure you, it was kind of an accident. I'd really just trying to make people laugh. But
in addressing we look at Community from season to season, there's this, when I go back to Hairless Apes, this kind of dawning of recognition in Jeff that well, no matter what he does, these people aren't going to hate him. But he still can't let his guard down. I mean, that feels like it to me, the crux of the way that show was built, whether you said it or not, that it was what you were thinking about as you were working on it.
Yeah, it's weird. I guess, I just got engaged to be married, and I guess the constant division between me and my fiance and I is, again, grammar.
As long as you correct it, that's what's important.
I mean, I won't risk diagnosing myself and shouldn't, but I mean, there's definitely some barriers, I guess, between me and other people that other people don't have, maybe. And so maybe like Mork from Ork, I kind of like examine that barrier more than other people because it's not there for them. They feel too much when they go to the grocery store. They know what their babysitter's thinking and feeling by looking at their face. And I guess maybe I don't all the time. And so I obsess about it.
But there's this issue of sort of self-knowledge. I mean, the characters who may be the worst characters in your stuff, and I'm not going to say villains, are kind of the people who know themselves. And the ones who aren't are the ones who are the most hapless.
Right. Yeah, self-awareness is definitely a bad thing in my mythology.
Yes, it is. It is.
Yeah, I think that's the one crime that we can really commit consciously is dishonesty. We all have that choice every step of the way. You get to tell the truth, or you get to go a one step further with thinking one thing and saying another, which we have a gift for as primates. We are political animals. We invented it, and we've created this society now where it's gonna kill us one day, and we also have this weird capacity for compassion and transparency. We're always asking ourselves every second, every breath we take, we have another. I guess that's where this concept, it's like free will versus fate. Like we ask ourselves, what is a decision? When are you making it? Are you just genetically compelled to want this and behave this way because of your various diagnoses? And then there's that mythology that I think we all kind of believe in and celebrate, which is no, hell no. We're all off-roading. We all have a steering wheel in our hands. We can absolutely wrench it one way or the other at any time. We just happen to not do that because you don't. But we all have it within us to just like go different ways anytime, which is insane to think, because why would that be the case?
What you're talking about is that narrative that's become this kind of covering cliche of mass media that you're constantly attacking. That we, these myths that we're told come from these things. Heroes all can make the decision to do the right thing and the wrong thing. When you actively make that decision, it's not something that's out of your hands. So in effect, you're responsible for the polar vortex on the East Coast by not having like put your turn indicator on when you went left. So,
right.
So you, again, these two kind of warring things are so much a part of what you do too.
I guess so. What are we going to do about it, Elvis? It all comes down to our duality giveaway.
Are you having more fun now that you're doing this? Are you having more fun in the show now, though? I mean, is it actively more fun? Because you got Chris back. I mean, yeah. Does it feel like a home to you at this point?
Yeah, I mean, if we got the pickup tomorrow, I would immediately call all of the writers from season 5 back. It's a unique season in that regard, in that there's not a single person that I'd be like, oh, good, let them take a hike. I mean, these were... I get to call them kids now. It's season 5. I'm 41. Like they are young, and they knew like coming in after all of that debacle for those that are familiar with it. Google my name if you don't. But season 4, and that's when we were sitting down to staff season 5. We were looking at it was like the first act of an underdog sports movie. You're looking at the only kids that didn't get snatched up by Parks and Rec. And they're for some reason, some weird reason, through fate or marriages or travel circumstances, here they are, and they know what Community is. They've heard the legends. They've read the comment section under Nikki Fink articles. They know they're going to be up until 4 a.m. until the story's right and all this stuff. And they're the ones that are saying, yes, I know about that, and I choose to sign on for this. And boy howdy, like that really, above anything, above any suit yelling at you about not having a templated show, that really wakes up your sense of responsibility. Because if you're late to work and those guys are like gonna have to stay there till 4 a.m, that's messed up.
It's weird because I love the show, and I've had Joel on a couple of times to talk about it, and it was so strange watching the episodes of last season, just because it felt like by imitating it on basic cable. I mean, there was all sort of all the superficial stuff there, but there was like this attempt to sort of, again, codify what you were inventing as you were going along.
Which I thought, yeah, that's remains such a mysterious choice to me. I can't tell if that's uplifting or heart-wrenching.
It's kind of a combination. I mean, it's kind of this awful cocktail of both. Because
I have no idea what happened behind those closed doors that would result in somebody going, okay, well, let's not turn this into just a regular old show, which would have been I would have destroyed me. Like, they could have made a good show. They could have made Brooklyn Nine-Nine at a community college. They could have made a Golden Globe mainstream, just good enough, like, good show. And the story would have been, yeah, get Ding Dong, the Witch is dead. Get this guy back to Milwaukee. And by some strange twist of fate, at some point, one of them started thinking that their responsibility was to continue to make the show completely unmarketable. As if to honor me. And I don't know who made that decision, and I don't know why they made it, but thank you.
7 seasons of the movie, Dan Harmon, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a special live edition of The Treatment, recorded in Pasadena with Dan Harmon, creator of Community and Rick and Morty. The show is mixed by Melissa Morton. It's edited, produced, and recorded by Jenny Radelet. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm not in Pasadena. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.